Hello there, my name is Chris Cook and welcome to TW Backstage. This is a brand new podcast from This Week Culture and 3 Weeks Edinburgh, all about the business of comedy and culture and theatre and fringe. On this podcast, we are going to be discussing all the key trends and developments and debates that are occurring within the comedy, theatre and fringe communities, while also explaining the inner workings of the cultural industries and how creative people go about building businesses and careers around their creativity. That's the brief, and we are kicking things off with this brand new podcast with 3 editions that we have recorded at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival, which, as this podcast goes live, is reaching its final few days. With the 3 Edinburgh recorded editions, well, what are we going to be talking about? Next week, with the festival just over, we are going to be asking, if you are a performer or a producer or a theatre company who were using this year's Edinburgh Fringe to try and build a profile and grow an audience, to build a network within the industry, with the festival over, what should you be doing in September to maintain any momentum you built? We've asked some experts that very question, and that's what we're going to be talking about next week. And then the following week, we're going to have an edition talking about the Comedians Charter that the Union Equity launched right back at the start of the festival earlier this month, what that's all about, and why we think that maybe now is the time that comedians and the comedy community really need to organise. So that is what we've got coming up in the next 2 editions recorded at the Edinburgh Festival. But for this edition, going out just as Festival 2022 reaches its climax, well, our remit this week is how to fix the Edinburgh Festival, which is quite a big objective for a first edition of a new podcast. It also is an objective that makes a big assumption that the Edinburgh Festival needs fixing. Does it? Well, maybe that's something we can talk about on this edition. So the Edinburgh Festival, let's just talk about that for a moment. Some of you tuning in, you know everything there is to know about the Edinburgh Festival. For some of you, maybe it's a mysterious beast off in the distance that you're not so familiar with. At 3 Weeks, we have been covering the Edinburgh Festival every year since 1996. So we do know a thing or two about this big festival that happens in the Scottish capital every August. We also know a thing or two about some of the issues with the Edinburgh Festival and why possibly you could argue that the Edinburgh Festival doesn't really work. Of course, whenever you're talking about the Edinburgh Festival, the first thing it's probably quite important to acknowledge is that the Edinburgh Festival doesn't really exist. There is no event that is actually called the Edinburgh Festival. Instead, it's actually an umbrella term that we tend to use for all of the different festivals that happen to take place in Edinburgh during August. What are those festivals? Well, let's list them. There's the Edinburgh International Festival, the Edinburgh International Film Festival, the Edinburgh International Book Festival, the Edinburgh Art Festival, the Festival of Politics, the Edinburgh Military Tattoo, and of course, the massive and magnificent Edinburgh Fringe. Now, when most people talk about the Edinburgh Festival, it's probably the Edinburgh Fringe that they're actually thinking about and talking about, and it's certainly going to be the Edinburgh Fringe that we're really focusing on here today. Although, we should acknowledge that if it wasn't for the Edinburgh International Festival, there wouldn't be a Fringe. The Edinburgh International Festival is a curated programme festival that takes place in Edinburgh each August, with a programme of theatre and dance and opera and music. And the International Festival has been happening in Edinburgh every year since 1947. So it all kicked off 75 years ago. And in that first year, 1947, a small group of theatre companies that were not part of the International Festival recognised that a load of people were going to come to Edinburgh that summer in order to consume culture and entertainment. And they saw an opportunity. And so they staged some shows on the fringe of the main festival, and in doing so, the Edinburgh Fringe was born. Not only that, but those initial fringe companies that took part in the first fringe, it wasn't called a fringe back then, but it basically was a fringe in 1947, those companies came up with a concept that is still core to the Edinburgh Fringe to this day. And that concept kind of works like this. There are lots of people looking for cultural entertainment in Edinburgh each August. And any performer, group, producer or company that wants to capitalise on that audience is welcome to present a show as part of this thing called the Fringe, providing they can find a room or a stage where they can legally perform. And that concept of Fringe and the Edinburgh Fringe, and it's been embraced by lots of other Fringe festivals around the world, of course, but that concept, I think, is a brilliant concept. It does mean that there is no quality control at the Edinburgh Fringe, and so therefore the quality of shows across the programme varies hugely. But it's that concept that means that Fringe festivals, and the Edinburgh Fringe in particular, become places where you can see and experience the kinds of shows that just would not get staged anywhere else. Shows that are new, shows that are still in development, shows that don't really work on paper, but which are brilliant on stage. And by employing that concept over the years and decades, the Edinburgh Fringe in particular has become a hotbed of creativity. People come to Edinburgh each August to try out and evolve new shows and new ideas, or to become better performers simply by performing the same show every day for a whole month. They also come to the Fringe in Edinburgh in August to find an audience, or to find champions within the cultural industries, people who might book their current show or commission the next one. And a lot of people come to the Fringe in August just to hang out for 3 weeks with a huge community of other performers and creators, to learn from those people, to be inspired by those people, to have those people critique their works and their performances, and to find future collaborators. For many people, performers, producers, creators, the real joy of the Fringe is just hanging out with that creative community for a few weeks in August in Edinburgh. And in a way, the Edinburgh Fringe is kind of a summer camp for actors and comedians and other performers. The Edinburgh Fringe is also a hotbed of creative entrepreneurs. Many early career producers and promoters and early stage theatre companies come to the Edinburgh Festival to learn their trade, to build a professional network and to find opportunities. Indeed, many performers, particularly those earlier in their career, but many other performers as well, actually produce their own shows at the Edinburgh Fringe. So as well as being performers, they are also producers. They are also part of that community of cultural entrepreneurs. And all that brilliant stuff is possible because of this wonderful concept of Fringe. Although, it has to be said that because of this loose concept, the Edinburgh Fringe can also be a bit confusing and a bit challenging for both audience members and performers alike. For example, while the Edinburgh Festival doesn't technically exist, the Edinburgh Fringe is pretty hard to define as well. Basically, anyone performing in Edinburgh in August who is not part of one of those other festivals is part of the Fringe. There is, of course, the Edinburgh Fringe Society, an organisation that compiles a programme, runs a box office and supports the Fringe community. But the Society doesn't own or programme the Fringe. It's an administrative body. You don't have to be in the Fringe Society's programme to be a Fringe show. All of which can make navigating the Edinburgh Fringe quite tricky. Of course, most Fringe performers perform at one of a network of independent Fringe venues, and many of those Fringe venues curate the shows that they are putting on and publish their own programmes. So the venues provide another network, another infrastructure via which you can navigate the Fringe Festival. However, we must acknowledge there are always fantastic things happening at the Fringe that are not in one of those traditional recognised Fringe venues. As for the challenges with the Fringe and the concept behind the Fringe, well, there are many challenges, and they are discussed every year in Edinburgh in August by the Fringe community, not least this year. Many of the challenges come down to money. It can be expensive staging a show at the Edinburgh Fringe, and many of the producers and promoters and theatre companies at the festival are taking a big financial risk. And remember, many performers are their own producers, so they are often the risk takers. Now, there are different approaches to performing at the festival, and some of those approaches are more expensive and more risky than others. And of those venues I talked about earlier, different venues work in different ways. So there are choices to be made in terms of how you do the Fringe, and one of the tricks is finding the way that works best for you. The Free Fringe movement that really started to gain momentum in the 2000s provided a great new approach that was particularly good for stand-up comedians. And for some stand-ups, it's only really because of the Free Fringe movement and what that became that they can still perform at Edinburgh every year. It's often said that it's impossible to make money performing at the Fringe, but that's not actually true. Depending on the kind of show you present and the model you adopt, you can make money at the festival. But at the same time, it's important to recognise that a lot of people do lose money performing and producing at the Fringe. Those who see the Fringe experience as basically a kind of summer holiday might just write off that loss as a cost of the experience. But for many people, that loss is actually an investment. They are making a loss at the Edinburgh Fringe in order to invest in their project or their company or their creative career. Either way, it does mean that there's an awful lot of risk-taking happening in August in Edinburgh every year. And inevitably, there are going to be winners and losers when it comes to capturing audience and making money at the box office. With so much risk being taken, commercial risk as well as creative risk, it's no wonder that the economics of the Fringe end up in the spotlight every August, just like this August. Every year, people will tell you that the Fringe isn't working anymore, that it's not viable for performers anymore, that it's become too expensive, too competitive, too commercial, that things just aren't as good as they used to be. Now, some of that criticism is valid, but not all of it. People have been saying all of those things every summer ever since I first came to the Edinburgh Fringe in 1994. And yet, since then, the Fringe has continued to evolve and grow. And so many great performers have found an audience and progressed their careers at this festival since the early 90s. So many great shows, so many great companies have come out of the Fringe. The festival continues to be that hotbed of creativity and creative entrepreneurs. And yet, it is right that we continue to acknowledge and discuss the challenges, economic and otherwise, and to seek to identify the criticism that is most valid and the issues that are most pressing, and then to ask, how can individual performers and producers and promoters and companies, and the entire Fringe community at large, meet those challenges and address those issues in a truly effective way that will ensure the long-term future of the Fringe while also enabling the festival to become ever more vibrant, more diverse, and more productive. In the last couple of years, of course, the Edinburgh Fringe community has faced some very unusual and very specific challenges stemming from the COVID pandemic, which forced the entire Edinburgh Festival, including the Fringe, to cancel completely in 2020, and for the Fringe to then run in a real streamlined way in 2021. As the festival seemed to return in full effect at the start of the month, I was really interested to know to what extent those COVID-specific challenges were still having an impact on what happens in Edinburgh in August. And as the wider Fringe community returned to Edinburgh en masse for the first time since 2019, I also wanted to know, of the various issues we can and do discuss, which were the really pressing issues for the Edinburgh Fringe right now. In terms of those already challenging economics, it's no secret that accommodation costs in Edinburgh have surged this year, in part due to measures introduced by the Scottish Government and Edinburgh City Council around things like student leases and Airbnb. Many of those measures probably make complete sense the rest of the year, but they have had a negative impact on the Edinburgh Fringe, meaning that there are fewer flats and apartments and rooms available to the Fringe community in Edinburgh each August. The aforementioned Fringe Society has also come under increased criticism of late, for example, over its failure to run an app at this year's festival, and about the way it received and distributed COVID funding made available by the Scottish Government. Some also say that the Society has become increasingly disconnected from parts of the Fringe community. Now, that's a criticism that's been made of the Fringe Society a number of times over the years, but maybe the unusual circumstances of the last 2 years have increased the disconnect. Then there's the reviews challenge. Reviews continue to play a really big role at the Edinburgh Fringe, but challenges within cultural journalism in general mean that there are fewer reviewers at the festival reviewing fewer shows. That's been a growing issue for a number of years, but one of the solutions pursued by the Fringe Society, which was to cover the accommodation costs of some journalists, but crucially, not all journalists, well, while that may have been a solution to a genuine problem, it's a solution that has proved controversial. Others continue to express concerns about the dominance of the bigger venues and the big-name comedians that operate at the festival, and that perceived continued commercialisation of the Fringe. Some people also note the ever-increasing number of Fringe bars and all the street food vendors on the streets of Edinburgh during August, and wonder whether, while all of that adds to the festival vibe, maybe it's taking people away from the shows and the performances that really make up the Fringe. And of course, once the 2022 Edinburgh Festival was underway, we also had an active cancel culture debate when the Pleasance, one of the big venue networks at the festival, decided to not allow Fringe veteran Jerry Sadovitz to do the second night of his planned two-night run. Why? Because, it turned out, that Jerry Sadovitz, a comedian who has spent 40 years courting controversy, whose entire marketing for his show is based around how controversial his act will be, well, the Pleasants decided that this time that act was too controversial. So, many issues and many challenges to discuss. To get a sense of which of those issues are most real and most pressing, I sat down at the space at Surgeons Hall, a venue right at the heart of the festival with shows happening all around me, and I spoke to a number of people who are working and performing and reviewing at this year's festival in order to get their take on the big Fringe debates and, if we concluded that the Fringe needed fixing, how we might go about doing that. I asked my guests whether they thought COVID was still having an impact on the Fringe, what they considered to be the biggest challenges facing the festival today, and what, if they were put in charge of the Fringe, they would change. So let's have a listen to what my guests said. We start with Charles Pament, Artistic Director of the Space Network of Venues. Space actually ran a venue at last year's streamlined Edinburgh Fringe and also presented an online programme of shows in 2020 and 2021. But with Edinburgh Festival 2022 seeming like the festival, the Fringe, was back to normal, I was interested to know from Charles what his take was. How are things going and where are we at in terms of the Fringe in general, but also the Fringe at the Space?
Where are we in the sense of size? We're slightly larger than we were in 2019. We popped another little studio space into the Symposium Hall Annex, which is part of our Surgeons Hall complex. In the sense of footfall, we're up a little bit and we're sort of 6,000 to 7,000 up on footfall in 19. So that's kind of very positive. Having done the Fringe in 2021, we were very confident that it would be successful, but we needed to keep an eye on prices and audience interest. The cost of living evolvement since then was starting to rear its head even then. And I think our success has come from over 300 of our shows still sticking ticket prices between £7 and £10, whereas other venues have flown through the sky. And I think that's changed. That will have an impact this year. I know the Fringe Society recommended or piloted and thought that £7 to £11 would be average. So we sit quite nicely in that. Where are we in comparison? It's difficult to say. Costs have flown up. Suppliers' costs have increased considerably. Accommodation costs, everyone knows the story on that. Thankfully, quite a lot of the venues, our landlords, suppliers, those very involved in the industry are sympathetic. And, you know, we're working together to keep each other going so we can evolve and develop. Some aspects of the accommodation doesn't play much part in that. It kind of feels as though it's on a different planet, and that's something I know the Fringe Society and all venues are keeping a keen eye on with council and government to try and repair a little bit for next year. But all in all, it's in a very positive place. I think on a creative level, it's fabulously positive. I think on a venue management level, there's areas where we all need to take reflection and focus on the welfare of participation rather than the costs, and find a happy medium of that, because without participation there's no oxygen and there's no festival.
I think that's an interesting point, that obviously we know the economic challenge, that it has always been an economic challenge to perform at the Fringe, but we know that it has increased for various reasons over the last few years, and so it's that challenge of keeping the ticket prices realistic, but at the same time recognizing that performers, venues, everybody, their costs are going up. But I think that performer welfare thing is another conversation which 10 years ago we were not really having at the festival. It has become a much bigger conversation in the wider industry. And I guess, you know, it is an economic challenge performing at the festival, but it's a mental, physical challenge as well. And do you think that, yeah, beyond the economics, that's another thing that venues and the Fringe Society need to be thinking about more? How can we support artists when they are going through what is, you know, emotionally, physically, mentally, a very challenging experience?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think most artists will come to you and they will talk about their financial constraints. If we can facilitate that a little better than some are, then that certainly helps the mental mental and health side. But, you know, on a separate level, I think the pastoral side is something we've been focused on for many years, and not just participation staff, you know, et cetera, the hours people work, how they're feeling each day, knowing that someone's available to have that chat. I mean, the society have been quite proactive in that, I know, as well. Ultimately, you know, as we move forward on a collective level, and hopefully on a collective level, that becomes a primary thing that we protect. You know, the days of expecting staff to work long hours for not much money have gone, I think, and should have gone. I'm not aware of any venues who do that anymore. And actually, I don't think that's happened for some years, even though it's been in the public eye. But certainly participation and that management of participation. You know, we're very focused on companies that can come for 1 week, driven by lifestyle and affordability. I never tell them that they need to come for longer just to get a review. I mean, a great example this year, we had two girls flew over from New York. They did 9 days. They had an audience Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They won a Fringe first on Friday. We threw an extra couple of shows in because they had the energy and the passion to do it. On the Sunday and Monday, their run finished formally on the Saturday. They're now back in New York focusing on the real world. And that's the prime example of what the Fringe can be and should be. And that's why it's so unique. There's no need to be here for 3 weeks to stretch, you know, considerably to over budget just because maybe a venue tells you to. Sit back, take it in, talk to everyone and feel it.
Now, you've alluded to some of this as we've gone, but if you were to pick out one or maybe two of the biggest challenges that the Fringe at large, the entire Fringe community, face, both in 2022, but as we look ahead to the next few years of the Fringe, what would you say that the top two challenges are?
Well, yes, I've alluded totally to the main figurehead, I think, which is making sure that we have participation in an affordable and healthy way. It's crucial. As I've said, they're the oxygen. Without performers, without creatives, without writing, without passion, there is no Edinburgh Festival Fringe. I think the other headline for me would probably be on the importance of what we call, and what most people will understand as the Fringe, what it is. There's a cloud and there's a bit of haze about what is the Fringe and what is the Fringe Society. The Fringe Society is a hugely important organisation, a charitable status organisation. Its structure's been here for many, many years. Its role is to facilitate venues, to support participants, to make sure that they can have the best time possible, to advise them accordingly with regards to selection of venues, or how they bring a show to Edinburgh, from press support to review management, etc. The Fringe itself is a collection of, I think the most important thing in the Fringe is the participation, the participants, and then the venues. It's the venues that build the relationship with the participants. It's the venues that probably take the risks a little bit more. They have to buy buildings and sometimes pay a lot of money a long way in advance. It's they that program and talk and work with participants to make this happen. And ultimately, I suppose it's the venues that generate the wealth. But that partnership between the Fringe Society and the venues needs to be closer. There needs to be closer collaboration. There needs to be healthy and sensible communication. And we should not lose sight that the Fringe is a collective of those things and not a society or the society. That's part of it. And it's, you know, I know it's, people say it's controversial, but it's not really. I think people need to understand that collective is very, very, very important for all of us. It's important that the Fringe Society exists, but it's important that the venues are treated in the same and collective way so we can support each other and create a professional and safe and actually functional environment where participation sits in the very roots of the festival as a platform for all, but also means that it offers the opportunity and the safe place for audiences to come and creatives to perform.
So if you were put in charge of the Edinburgh Fringe tomorrow, if it was something you could change, what would it be?
There's not lots hugely wrong. There's things that need connecting, as I've said. But I think ultimately it's that definition. It really is that global understanding of what the Fringe is. If you ask people wandering around the street, they think the Fringe is the Fringe Society, and it's not. The Fringe is the collective of participants and venues and stakeholders and those who come together to create it. It's the carnival, but they're all as important as each other. But that, you know, that needs recognition. I think when you look at where the funding has gone for the fringe, for example, that's gone from Scottish Government to the Fringe Society. Perhaps that should have gone to the fringe, and those Scottish Government should have been speaking directly to those who are the fringe, not just, there's this figurehead mentality, which I think is a worry and it's a concern. It's not a huge issue, but it is something that needs to be reflected on and changed, I think.
My next guest is Innes Worth, a producer who has presented shows at The Fringe, including theatre and comedy, since 2005, and who is presenting four shows at this year's festival. I started by asking Innes if she thought The Fringe was fully back this year.
You know, on one hand, I feel we're completely back, but then maybe like 50% of your question, we're completely back, and then 50% of your question is still, you know, we're still kind of trying to be back. It was very bumpy in the very beginning when I first came here, you know, the beginning of August, like I would say the first few days, just because I think everybody's kind of finding their way back, you know, all the way from the shows to the venues to the audiences to even restaurants and bars, and everybody really is, you know, was kind of trying to get back. But I'm finding the momentum is kind of has started halfway through the Fringe. So I feel the momentum has really picked up now halfway through the Fringe, and hopefully it's going to stay there until the end.
I guess it's interesting that, because I suppose the start of the Fringe is always quite chaotic because you've got everybody returning, everyone trying to remember how you build your venues and how the Fringe shows. But I guess with that 2-year break, especially for those people, obviously some people were here last year, but a lot of people were not. Some of it was just readjusting to what it is to arrive in this city, for these venues to pop up and everyone to suddenly go into a show a day for 25 days.
Yeah, people have definitely come back. And the want and the need to be back to Edinburgh is ginormous. People are so passionate, all the way from, you know, the venue managers, the venue staff, all the shows, all the performers that I keep meeting across the board. Everybody's really, really passionate to be back and for the Fringe to kind of get back to normal.
Now, every year at the Fringe, there are always certain issues that performers and producers and promoters raise with putting on shows here or seeing shows here. If you could pick out one or maybe two, what would you say are the big challenges that the Fringe at large is facing this year and maybe in the next few years ahead?
I think the number one challenge, for sure, number one, and the long list goes, and again, number one, is accommodation. Accommodation has been a huge struggle for everyone, for the performers, for all the companies, for the venues, the venue staff. I mean, all across the board, it's been a huge struggle because the prices of accommodations have probably doubled, if not tripled. So that's been a really, 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 you know, big struggle for, I think, everyone.
And I suppose to put that in context, I mean, the cost of renting a flat in August in Edinburgh in 2018, 2019, it was a big part of your budget already. So if those costs are doubling, maybe even tripling, that is a significant uplifting cost.
It's significant. I mean, if you have a company of, let's say, you know, 5 or 6 people, it becomes half of your budget, you know, which is crazy. It becomes half of your budget, you know? So I would say that's a big concern and a big issue that we're all dealing with this year. And then another issue is just, you know, the audiences are kind of coming back. So I just want to encourage everybody because, you know, the venues are so excited. The performers are so excited. Producers are so excited. The PR and marketing, like everybody is so excited that we just really want you guys, the audience, to come and experience this incredible thing of, you know, we're back to 3,000 shows per day. And it's just such an incredible thing for the audience to come and experience that. So yes, please come join us.
Do you think in terms of the audience, I mean, there's two sides to that in terms of maybe we've lost some of the audience this year compared to, say, 2019. Partly that might be maybe we don't have as many international people here as we normally would. International travel has sort of come back online, but only relatively in the last, you know, 6 months. So maybe there are fewer international people here. But then is there, with a big local audience, for example, maybe people kind of got out of the habit of going out and seeing free shows in an evening and getting a meal in the middle of it. So maybe it's just getting people back into the habit of this is the best place to be in August go and have an evening at the Fringe, see a few shows and make that part of your year.
Yes, for sure. And I know I've talked to some venues and they're pushing offers for the locals, either, you know, 2-for-1s or any kind of, you know, ticket offers that, that they have. So the locals are more interested to come and be a part of the Fringe. And also, the, you know, I think the weather has been a big part of it because, you know, the whole beginning into just a few days ago, the weather was so amazing that the locals probably just want to go and enjoy, you know, because they get such little, you know, so few days of nice weather that I think they've really been enjoying doing other things and not really being a part of the Fringe.
Yeah, that's the madness of the Edinburgh Fringe. It's a festival where actually we quite like the drizzle because it encourages people to come inside and see the show.
Exactly, exactly. I think it does encourage because people don't want to sit around at home. You know, they want to be out, but, you know, when it's raining really badly, it's nice to be in the theater so they can come and join us, you know, see some incredible shows.
Let's say tomorrow you were put in charge of the Fringe. I mean, is there something that, that you would change that might either address some of the issues you've already raised or just make the festival better, whether that's for performers, producers, or audience members?
Again, I would try to really push the city of Edinburgh somehow enforce the accommodation cap, whether that be, you know, the student accommodation being more available for companies to come and take over when the students are not around. That would, I think, probably be my priority number one, because I think there's certainly a huge amount of content, a huge amount of passion, a huge amount of professionalism amongst the venues, at least that I work with. You know, I usually work with Assembly, Gilded Balloon, Pleasance, and my venues I have no issues with because they've always been incredible, and I'm super excited about all my venues. So, you know, it really is accommodation that's been the huge thing that I would want to really work on. And I know people have tried, you know, but I think we maybe just need to, you know, push the city and push the government a little bit more on our side.
Next up, I spoke to comedian Ivor Dembina, a comedian who originally came to the Fringe back in the day as a promoter and who still runs a comedy night the rest of the year, but who now primarily performs when at the Edinburgh Fringe. I asked Ivor how he thought Fringe 2022 was going.
I think it's a poorly attended festival. I found out yesterday was my day off and I had a wander. I just went out just around the streets, you know, to just do some shopping, you know, and looking in here and there, and it's quiet. I mean, I think everybody's out watching Jerry Sadowitz.
They could try.
It's definitely a quiet, what anyone tells you, it's a quiet festival. I think there's some serious thinking that needs doing. Obviously COVID interrupted the calendar, but you can't blame COVID for everything. COVID interrupted everyone, and you can't blame COVID. But I think this is a great opportunity for the Fringe community, if I can use that word, to take a step back and stop and look where they are, because I think the Fringe is in crisis now. I think I just don't think the same number of people's coming. I think some of the power brokers at the Fringe have demonstrated their incompetence. There's no getting away from it. You know, notably the Fringe Society with the app and all this stuff. The Pleasance have made this disastrous mistake over Jerry Sadowitz. And I think people... it's time. It was coming at some point or other. I think the COVID sped it up, and it was sooner or later that the Fringe was going to get a punch on the nose. There's always been, ever since I've been coming, which I think, I can't remember what year, but it was in the mid-1980s, there's always been a tension between the creative artistic spirit of the Fringe, as it's called, and the Fringe Festival is a trade fair. That tension's always existed, and sometimes it's produced a quite a healthy tension. But in recent years, the corporate identity has triumphed, and look where it's got us. The place is in a right old mess, and it's time to start again. You know, I say to the people younger than me who ask me, should I go to Edinburgh? The thing about going to Edinburgh is make sure you know why you are going. Just don't go. I've come unstuck a couple of times, and the times my shows have tanked has been because I just went because I thought, oh, I ought to be there.
And also, I think in the stand-up comedy world, there is a sort of it's August, I should be in Edinburgh. So almost it's just like, it's in the diary, I go. But I think, yeah, it's every year be thinking, why am I going this year? What do I want to get out of it?
And go as long as you know what the reason is. The reason I come to Edinburgh, and I do enjoy it, don't get me wrong, and I've got loads out of it, is it's the only, I'm not a particularly famous or, how shall I say, in-demand comedian. It's the only opportunity that I, in a year, where I get an opportunity to perform 20, 22 times consecutively in the same venue at the same time of day to roughly the same audience. So it's the nearest that I get to a laboratory, so I can look how the standard of my art was at the beginning and then look at it at the end and see whether it's improved or not. The main reason I would suggest to come to Edinburgh is to get better at what you do. And anything else is, well, you know, what's the point of becoming famous if you haven't improved as a comedian? You'll get found out, you know, rightly.
You said dramatically, we need to start again. Are you optimistic that something will change? I mean, I think with the Free Fringe movement, the Free Festival movement, which it's been going for what, more than 20 years, but really started to gain momentum in the mid-2000s. And when it happened, that was really exciting because the festival had got a lot of comedians were being priced out. And, you know, providing you have the sort of show that works within the Free Fringe and Free Festival, that was brilliant. It was a really big change and it was great. Do you think that there's another grassroots initiative that could come through? Are you optimistic that some of these challenges will be met?
No. That beautifully composed question. I don't know. Well, it's like all changes. Everyone knows they've happened once they've happened. I don't know where it's going to come from, but something is going to have to change. Part of the problem, and I don't want to disrespect the people who work very hard, including me, to come up here. What happened pre-COVID is that the Fringe grew exponentially. Every year it was bigger, more shows, more this, more venues, more higher prices, and it just got, and then it became a balloon, I think that's a good way, and then COVID was the pin that pricked it. It was gonna happen sooner or later, so no one saw COVID coming. And, it's got to, I'll tell you what, you know, the Edinburgh Fringe has got to do. It's got to get out of its own arse. Stop telling itself how wonderful it is, you know, and say, right, we are now, this is who we are, this is what we do, and, start again was kind of a little bit of an exaggeration, but it definitely needs a kind of a bucket of water, cold bucket of water over its head.
Another comedian now, this time Alistair Barry, who has performed at the Fringe for years, having first come to the festival in 1991 as a student actor. This year is the 20th anniversary of him performing his first solo show at the festival. He's performed at various Fringe venues over the last 20 years, but these days presents his show as part of the PBH Free Fringe. I started by asking Alistair if the Fringe was now properly back to normal.
Well, of course it's not back to where it was because the Fringe changes every year. And I mean, when you've done as many as I have and as many others have, then you get a feel for the whole thing and certain familiarities. But that's the beauty of the Fringe, is it's an individual beast. Every year is different and the same. I mean, I'm amused by your use of the word streamlined for last year, because that was, it was hilarious. I actually came up and did six nights because I realized I'd actually written an hour over lockdown. And my wife said, go and do a show then. And I got a room and it was sold out every night. I'm very lucky. I sell pretty well up here, but it was easier to fill last year. And it was great fun. I mean, because there was, 400 shows as opposed to 4,000 or whatever. This year, there is obviously the hangover of COVID, but I think it would be only the Fringe would go, is the Fringe okay? Forgetting the fact that there's been a global pandemic that's affected pretty much everything. And so I do think there are repercussions. I think there are serious problems with the Fringe that I don't think are being addressed properly. But then look at the government. I mean, it's not exactly something that's not happening on a wider level. What kind of amused me this year is the amount of people running around in the first week going, one of my techs hasn't turned up, this isn't happening, that's not happening, as though every year the Fringe just sort of gently hits the runway in the smoothest possible fashion and everything is five stars and absolutely perfect from the get-go. The Fringe by its very nature, is ad hoc. The first week is full of people panicking. The last week is full of people crying. There's everything on the fringe. So I think there are definite serious problems that need addressing. But I also think there was a slight element this year of going, well, the fact we haven't been here properly for 2 years means it's a disaster. And you do kind of go, yeah, you're actors and comedians and somewhat self-obsessed narcissists. It's not that bad.
Yeah, no, if everything's falling apart and nothing's quite working, that's the fringe back to normal.
It's not the fringe if it's not doing that, is it? So,
if I was to ask you to pick one or two of the big challenges that you think the fringe community, so in that we're including all the performers, the comedians, the actors, the companies, the venues, what are a couple of the big challenges that the fringe is currently facing?
Well, as always, it's money. And I think the bottom line is, for instance, there was money handed to the Fringe Society that they spread out among certain producers and venues, but not to all of them. There's an utter lack of transparency. I'm appalled by the Fringe Society on a number of levels, putting up journalists from certain publications and not from others, and giving them no conditions to who they should review. I found that deeply offensive. I haven't been reviewed by a national in quite some time. In fact, the same reviewers have reviewed me for the last 10 years. 3 weeks haven't reviewed me for 10 years. I thought I'd just get that in. I seem to remember 2012, the only thing remarkable about Alison Barry's material was just how unremarkable it is. It's amazing how we remember these things, Chris. But
we'll have to fix that. I don't quite know how, but we'll do it somehow.
No. My point, on a serious note, the point is it's a well-known fact that the bigger reviewers head towards those at the bigger venues, those with bigger PR, the bigger names. That's fine. I know the world's not fair, but I don't expect to subsidise their rents. I think the lack of an app is appalling. I think the fact that the Fringe Society offered to refund people fully because of the app, but then said, oh, but you'll have to lose all your listings, which also means you lose entry into the Comedy Award. That's horrific bullying. That is basically saying we were wrong, but we're using our muscle to prevent you doing anything about it, to accept responsibility. I think that's disgraceful. But on a much larger level, the Fringe is not the Fringe Society. I was talking to a couple on the bus on the way in today, because I live out in Portobello where my family come up. And they were just a lovely late middle-aged couple who come up to the Fringe. And they were saying it's really been hard this year. And it's one thing, I mean, as a performer who always employs a couple of flyerers this year, good ones, have been like gold dust. Because people who would come up and sleep in student digs and earn 10 to 12 quid an hour and have an incredible experience at the biggest arts festival in the world are looking at it now going, I simply can't afford to come up. That's the same for performers. But more importantly, and this is what everyone seems to forget, the Edinburgh Fringe isn't just performers. If you haven't got an audience, then you haven't got a fringe. And I really think that Edinburgh itself is pricing audience out. And it's almost like this is the forgotten equation in our massive self-involvement, that we go, I cannot believe I've had to pay £3,000 for a room in Marchmont. You go, what about the 60 people you want in your room every day to fill it? They're not all from Edinburgh. When I first started coming to the Fringe, it was, you know, there were loads of people who would go, this is my summer holiday. And there still are, but I get the definite feeling there's a lot less. There are a lot less. I think audience numbers are down across the Fringe. That's anecdotal. But that's what everyone's saying. I mean, there is an element that they say that every year, 10 o'clock and they wouldn't come in. But I do think audience is down. I've noted, because I'm on the Free Fringe, and I think the Free Fringe is a really great institution that I think has been totally ignored by the Fringe. I think it scares the Fringe Society. You know, all I really need is a microphone in a room, and I do that, and I'm lucky enough that I've got a decent reputation and I sell well. But I've noticed that buckets are down, and that's not surprising. I don't know if you've seen your last energy bill. So I'm not surprised that buckets are down and audiences are down, but I think the Fringe needs to get better care of its audience. Yes, it's very important it takes care of the performers and the venues and the journal. But the audience is the ones. An arts festival without an audience is just navel-gazing.
Now, in terms of the various issues that you've mentioned there, so economics and accommodation, I guess, being the big two, and they're kind of two sides of the same coin. But as you also said at the start, they're not just Edinburgh problems, they are global problems. And I guess, you know, that's what happens here is, you know, what the global problems are then escalated in the context of culture and comedy here. We're not going to solve those problems on an interview on a podcast, but I feel that sort of what you're saying is, well, you know, the Edinburgh Council, the Edinburgh Fringe Society, the organisations who are endeavouring to address some of these issues, it feels like you're saying there's a disconnect between those organisations and the community that they're here to support and they're trying to solve problems for, and that maybe they're talking to a relatively small part of the fringe community, but a lot of that community is being left out of the conversation and the communication.
Well, I think generally, if you look across the board, I mean, when I first came up as a student actor, I was sort of sat in the Fringe bar and the Doug Anthony All-Stars would come past and give you a flyer. You know, you don't see Frankie Boyle coming past giving you a flyer now. It's become a much, everyone knows it, and it's what happens to everything. It's become a much more corporate structure. The big four were not the big four then. The underbelly didn't exist. And it seems very clear that everything is weighted towards them. I also think the biggest change in the Fringe really was when the underbelly turned up and put the upside down purple cow in Bristow Square. I was performing a play, I don't know if it was the first year, but I would, 2012, I did a play called Breaker Morant with Adam Hills and Brendan Burns and a few others, Sammy J. And, you know, it was an arts venue with a courtyard where you could have a drink. You go there now, and the arts venue's disappeared, and there's a massive courtyard. And it's all pop-up food boutiques all around it. What it looks like now, as you talk about a disconnect, it's less an arts festival, as though the arts festival is a sort of excuse for the massive piss-up that goes on everywhere. George Square, similar sort of thing. Yes, there are venues there, but you sort of go, is the venue more important, or is the Vietnamese banh mi pop-up more important? I do think there's a disconnect. As I say, I have a slight axe to grind as someone who works with the PBH Free Fringe, because they got no money from this handout, and yet they handed money out to the big four with very little transparency. And that is not just registration money that comes from people like me. That's also money that's coming from government to support the industry, allegedly. But as with so many industries, it's given to someone who then goes, we have handed out stuff with no transparency, no acknowledgement of those who've received nothing. The Stand. I mean, The Stand is an utter Edinburgh institution. Got nothing. That's despicable. And I think there is, I mean, there's obviously COVID has had such an effect on my industry across the board. Very little of it filters down to the comedians. Of course I'd say that. I'm a comedian. But I do. I think you're right. The disconnect is palpable, and there is a sense of you should be grateful that we have come, and here's our munificence, and oh, you can photocopy in our office. Fine. That's not what I'd like to insist that the Guardian reviewer reviews at least two shows on the Free Fringe for every one or two that they do at one of the big venues. I mean, and I'm not attacking individual journalists. They go where they go. But if you're going to get your rent paid, then there should be some conditions attached when it's other people's money. Yeah, I think disconnect is the word.
You talked about the Free Fringe, and I think, you know, obviously that 20 years ago, I guess, was the origins of the Free Fringe, but it really started to gain momentum in the late 2000s, I guess. And that was a grassroots initiative that addressed what was becoming a problem at that time, which was lots of stand-ups were being priced out, and the Free Fringe model was a really good model. And it wasn't that the Fringe Society came up with that. City Council didn't come up with that. And obviously, Peter Buckley Hill had the idea, and then a community grew around it. And obviously, there was then the spin-off Free Festival. We won't get into the politics around that. But I think the concept of the Free Fringe was brilliant, and it was a grassroots solution to a problem that was growing at that time. Do you think there's a grassroots solution to any of these problems, or does it need the council, the Fringe Society, and organisations like that to connect with the community and find the solution?
I think it's a very good and very difficult question. And the thing that annoys me most about the Free Fringe, the way the Free Fringe is viewed, is this idea that it's not going to be as good. There's going to be terrible shows everywhere. There's going to be great shows everywhere. Speaking on a very simple level, I mean, I first did Peter Buckley Hill and some comedians in 1999 when I came up as an open spot with on a bill with Adam Hills and Ross Noble. So obviously I headlined. But I think it's a great initiative. There is still a certain stigma. You're basically in a, not a street performer, but you are asking for donations at the end. There is a slight element of, again, you know, you don't get Jimmy Carr standing at the end of his show with a bucket, and it's as simple as that. But I know that I cannot afford to do the Fringe any other way. I do a good show, the reviews will bear that out, and I ask people to give me a tenner each, and many do, some give a bit more, a lot can't afford it, and it's fine. But it's a great model, a grassroots model. Now, is there a grassroots solution to this? I don't know, because if you're going to have something like the Fringe Society giving out money and completely ignoring The Stand, who've got an enormous presence on the other side of town, completely ignoring the Free Fringe, well, PBH's Free Fringe, but not the other Free Fringe. I mean, that's incredibly, you know, two free fringes and one gets money and one doesn't. That's incredibly divisive. Is there a grassroots solution? I don't know that there's a grassroots solution until the fringe is viewed under one umbrella. And I don't feel it is, as just proven by what I've just said. I do think there needs to be serious thought. You know, how do you stop people charging through their teeth for their accommodation? It's a really difficult problem. Is it intractable? I don't know. Is there a grassroots solution? I don't know. But there has to be a solution that isn't so divisive. You know, at the risk of repeating myself, you're handing out money and you don't give it to two really big producers. You're immediately, it's divide and rule.
My final guest is here to give a reviewer's perspective of The Fringe. Richard Stamp is co-founder of the Fringe Guru website and currently reviews at the Edinburgh Festival for the Wee Review. I started by asking him my usual first question. How is he finding Fringe 2022, and are we fully back after the COVID years?
I think we've all been surprised by how it's just popped back in 2022. It almost feels like we all went away into a bubble for a couple of years, and now we're back to the way things always were. But then when you look a bit more deeply, you can see some fault lines. I'm particularly struck by the venues who haven't come back. So the big ones are all back, but the likes of PQA venues, which was one of my favourites in 2019, or Venue 13, which was a lovely venue, which has been here for forever on the Royal Mile, those aren't here now. And I do really feel those losses.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, there's been some of those smaller venues, and some of which, like Venue 13, have been around for as long as anybody can remember. They're not back, and I suppose we don't necessarily know why is that, but I suppose a lot of those were run by smaller organisations. They were often run not for business, but for passion, and maybe having had those 2 years off, they've just found another way to spend their August. And so I guess the question is, will those organisations come back? Possibly not, but all those therefore buildings that other people might take the mantle with next year. So even if the people behind those venues don't come back, those spaces will become theatres again.
Well, the thing that I fear is that the big four or other big chains will spread out into those spaces. So that hasn't happened for PQA and for PQA venues home in Riddle Court. That's been taken over by Greenside, who are absolutely running and programming it in the kind of way that PQA would have done. But for other spaces, I mean, the Bedlam Theatre is closed this year, and that's in prime territory to be taken over by, say, the Gilded Balloon or the Underbelly. And that would be a shame. No disrespect to those organisations. They do some great work, but we need the smaller venues. We need the more independent spaces in the Fringe as well.
Obviously, every year at the Fringe, there are lots of conversations about, oh, the problem with the Fringe is dot, dot, dot. Beyond that, as we've come back after the pandemic, some of those smaller, truly fringe venues are not here. Maybe they'll come back next year. Maybe they won't. But beyond that, if you had to pick one or maybe two of the big challenges for the Fringe at large, what would you pick?
Well, the number one challenge has to be the cost of accommodation, but I've got no solutions for that except for rent control. It's a much bigger society problem, which won't be solved within the Fringe community. So I'm going to talk about just the loss of experience, I suppose, over the period of the pandemic, within the Fringe society, within the venues, and just in general about the way that the Fringe works. That there were patterns which built up over many, many years, which kind of worked. And some of those have now, you know, that cultural knowledge has been lost and we're having to reinvent things. And my worry is that it's going to be reinvented along much more corporate lines than it was before the pandemic.
Interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose there are two possible routes that goes. One is that the corporates come in and fill the gap. I suppose the other optimistic viewpoint is maybe there are some young, not necessarily young, early career entrepreneurial people who will randomly find a way to fill that gap in the next couple of years and will get a whole new generation, a whole new breed of truly fringe people involved in the festival. Do you share any of that optimism?
Well, I do. I don't want to be one of those people who says that all change is bad. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I just feel, I was having a conversation with the Fringe Society last week about the way that press ticketing works. And I came out of that thinking, I understand this problem better than you do, because I've been doing this for 15 years and the person I'm speaking to, I think was brand new. And so it's a question of engaging with those longer serving stakeholders and not just thinking that you can solve all the problems yourself. That would be the advice I give to the Fringe Society and to the venues.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Because I mean, what is brilliant about the Fringe is a whole new generation come through every few years, shake things up, new things happen. That's brilliant. brilliant. But at the same time, behind the scenes, there are people who've been around for a very long time who understand some of the technicalities of putting on a festival this big for 3 weeks of the year. So I guess making sure that while it's great that new people come through all the time, that that knowledge is still being accessed and acknowledged where it can really add value.
Absolutely so. And, you know, just to balance it up, let me give one example of something that's changed that is really positive, and that's e-ticketing. For us in the press, it's so much simpler now that we get the tickets through to our mobile phones. And without there having been a disruption, maybe that would never have happened. Maybe we just have carried on with a really rather baroque arrangements that there always used to be. So yeah, there are opportunities, but there are threats as well.
If you were put in charge of the Fringe tomorrow and you could change one thing about the festival, the way it runs, this could be the Fringe Society, but it could just be the festival at large, or the way the city interacts with the festival, what would your one big change be?
Those are two slightly different questions. If I was in charge of the Fringe Society, then I think what I would most try to do is to reconnect with the grassroots, with the small stakeholders. I mean, just by way of anecdote, I'm a best friend of the Fringe, as they call it, so that's just a charity donation that you make every year. It's not a large amount, it's £150. But this year, for the first time, they stopped acknowledging that in the printed programme. And that feels like a slap. It feels like they're moving away from their real supporters, the grassroots supporters. So I hope that they will notice that and course correct. If I could change one thing about the Fringe, and I'm going to say something really controversial here, I would give Adam House back to C Venues. Not saying anything against the Gilded Balloon. They had an opportunity and they took it. But C Venues, both in Adam House and across the Fringe, did so much to champion a particularly unusual type of work. The likes of Belt Up Theatre, who did astonishing, immersive, interactive work. And I don't really know where that kind of work goes now. I can't think of a home for it anywhere, unless they're going to take over a derelict building themselves and, you know, do all the work themselves. And it feels that through having lost that central location, Adam House, C Venues has been really diminished. And that, I know the controversy, I'm not going to talk about that, but just in terms of the art, I think that is a real shame.
So I guess that comes back to this idea of the Fringe operates at many levels, and I'm nervous even using that word, because that suggests there's a bottom level and a top level, and that's not what we mean, although we are prone to say the big venues, the big promoters. But I guess all of those levels are equally important at the Fringe, and whether it is the super small venues who put on, you know, six shows a day, or whether it is the sort of the C venues that found a niche that was different to what Gilded Balloon and Underbelly, etc. were doing, all of those levels are required. And if we lose some of those levels, it kind of loses what makes Edinburgh special.
Yeah, I agree. And you're right, we shouldn't talk about the big venues, because the biggest venue at the Edinburgh Fringe, of course, by quite a long way, is space. And that's not what anybody means when they talk about the big venues. But there are venues which aim for more professional companies, and there are venues which offer the route in for younger companies. But what I think we are in danger of losing is the tier in between. So the small theatre companies who might come here trying to get interest for a rural tour, for example, who would always lose money at Edinburgh, but they would find, you know, they would find a home and they wouldn't lose too much money. I think that's the squeezed middle in the Fringe economy at the moment.
Thanks so much to my five guests for joining me on this very first edition of TW Backstage to give me their insights on all things Edinburgh Fringe. Of course, we haven't really fixed the Edinburgh Festival in a single podcast, and nor did we expect to. However, what I hope we have done is put the spotlight on some of the challenges that the Fringe community are currently facing, provided some clarity on which of those challenges are most pressing, and maybe we even got to share a few possible solutions for consideration along the way. Edinburgh City Council, the Scottish Government, and of course the Fringe Society obviously have an important role to play in dealing with at least some of these challenges, though doing so will require all three of them to fully connect with and talk to the wider Fringe community. That's no small task, but it's clearly a really important one. Though I suspect some of the solutions to some of these challenges and issues will actually come from within the Fringe community itself. This is, as I alluded to earlier, as much a festival of cultural entrepreneurs as it is a festival of culture. And I reckon somewhere in that Fringe community, there are rising entrepreneurial talents who will address some of these challenges through innovative new approaches and business ventures. And I hope that the Fringe community will spot those talents and embrace and support them. That's all we have time for on this very first edition of TW Backstage. Each edition of this podcast will be a little bit different, but every edition will put the spotlight in some way on the business of comedy and culture, theatre and fringe. We have two more editions that we've recorded at the Edinburgh Festival, as I mentioned at the start. Next week, with the festival done and dusted for another year, we will be looking at those performers and producers who were using the fringe to build profile and make connections and to open up opportunities, and asking what should they be doing now the festival is over to build upon any momentum that was achieved during August. Then the following week, we're going to be putting a spotlight on the Comedians Charter that Equity launched right back at the start of the festival and what that is all about. Then later in September, we have a few editions ready to go in which we'll be sharing some panel discussions about the business of comedy in 2022 that we recorded at another festival at Cambridge Sound and Vision earlier this year. So lots coming up in the next few weeks with this brand new podcast. So you know what you need to do? You need to get subscribed, don't you? Sign up to TW Backstage in whatever podcast app you use, and we will pop up in your feed as each new edition goes live. You should also sign up to our TW Weekly Bulletin that comes out every Monday morning. It's full of free-to-see show recommendations for London and online and beyond. Plus, my colleague Caro interviews some of her favourite performers and producers and writers each week. And we'll give you updates on what is happening with TW Backstage. So sign up for the bulletin as well. And if you know anybody else working in or interested in comedy, culture, theatre or fringe, tell them about this podcast. Maybe they can get signed up too. Thank you for listening. TW Backstage is a podcast from This Week Culture and Free Weeks Edinburgh. It's presented by me, Chris Cook. And for more great cultural stuff, check us out at thisweekculture.com.